I pledge allegiance to the red, white, and brew. Yeah, welcome to Red, White, and Brew with Gru. I'm Greg Grugan, and as I've said before, this is my dream job, talking to smart, interesting people that I know and admire while drinking a brew. So I have one of those guys here with me tonight, someone we all owe a debt of gratitude. His name is Chris Diaz. He is a retired DEA agent and a fellow autism father. And, you know, glad to have you here, brother. Here.
Thank you very much. Hold on. Wait, do I do the ceremonial? I know, yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. Like love that sound.
Yes.
All right, here, let's get going here.
Cheers.
Hey, how did you get into law enforcement? Give me the elevator speech.
I went to James Madison University. I went for music. I was a music performance major. And then I decided to pick a career that would pay a little bit less than a music teacher, and I went into law enforcement. Hired on at Albemarle County Police Department, worked about 4 years and 7 months, and then I was picked up by DEA. And I had a very, very blessed career and worked for about 22 years, 9 months. And on my 50th birthday, New Year's Eve, I decided to punch out. So approximately 27 years of public service, grinding for Uncle Sam, I decided to go ahead and grind for my family.
Hey, I'm going to get straight to it. You know, you worked in South American countries.
I did.
In the heart of drug trafficking operations. Give me your assessment of the vicious nature of the cartels.
Oh, I mean, we don't have all day. It's, there are organizations globally that operate in another world that most citizens in the United States should be thankful that they have no concept of how they're operating. Yeah. Incredibly violent. Their nature of corruption knows no bounds. They have a bottomless checkbook, and they don't have rules, regulations, or laws to prevent them from accomplishing what they attempt to see as their mission.
And zero respect for life.
Zero. Absolutely. Like that's inconsequential. Even their own lives. Their own lives. They understand that their lives are going to be lived fast. It's going to be lived violent. And they know that their life is going to be short.
So were there particular organizations that rose above the others in terms of ferocity?
In my experience, I started DEA in 2002. My career began in Laredo, Texas. And not just Laredo, Texas. I did work in Mexico for brief moments in time. And then I was stationed permanently in Guatemala. And for me, the Mexican cartels were the most ruthless, specifically during that era. It was the Zetas, which was an enforcement arm of the Gulf cartel early on, and then later they split.
Former military, some of those guys?
Former Mexican special forces. And then they, over the generations, generation as in, as new inductees would come in, they would get training, and then it would just get watered down into the normal populace who became traffickers.
Yeah, we had Congressman Dan Crenshaw on, and Dan talks about how the cartels have infiltrated every phase of Mexican society, almost to the point of creating a failed state, a narco state. Would you agree with that assessment?
100%. From human trafficking, sex trafficking, narcotics trafficking, the illegal sale of cigarettes to stealing oil and gas reserves to changing the market price value of avocados. Their hands are in every proverbial pie amongst that country.
So did it ever feel kind of like Sisyphus? You would make huge arrests,
Sisyphus is that Greek character.
I was going to ask you. I don't know what that means. Could you help me out?
He was condemned by the gods to push a boulder up a mountain, and every time he almost got to the top, it would roll back down again, and he would have to start pushing it again. That was his fate. Were you ever discouraged about the fight?
No, I mean, there's a certain aspect of understanding that there are going to be vacuums of power when you effectively change. You can see when we were doing a good job because the market value of drugs that were in the United States would increase in value and the purity levels would be low in value. That's how you knew that you were affecting change. Also, you would have inside knowledge of how creating a strong border is reducing the flow of drugs. And during the, I have memory of when Trump was originally elected as president, how there was amongst the narco community that there was a fear of him, and that people were becoming very, very precarious and careful in the drug culture about how they were going to ship drugs and what they were going to do. It's very notable.
You know, we have had a shift in politics, even from the first Trump administration, a more strident, more ferocious response to those who are shipping particularly fentanyl into this country. And so I want to talk about that. I want to get your personal feelings as an American citizen on that when we come back after this quick break.
I pledge allegiance to the red, white, and blue.
Welcome back to Red, White, and Brews with my friend, retired DEA agent, Chris Diaz. Chris, thanks for spending some time with me. Hey, look, brother, I can't have you here and not talk about the fact that for years, you worked undercover internationally, building up personas that were credible and able of inflicting huge damage and taking down entire operations. How much of that can you talk about? Can you talk about the process of building a persona in order to entrap these, you know,
No entrapment.
Not in the legal sense. To capture and catch with credible evidence.
Right on. Yeah, I can talk a little bit about it.
Okay.
I can't get into the nitty gritty. As far as building a persona, I truly believe that there's a lot of study involved. I was very fortunate to have a solid team working together with other federal agencies, from the United States Marshals to FBI to HSI, and we happen to be all friends. But I will honestly say that they were the smartest people in those agencies, and that's why I enjoyed working with them. We had the capability of traveling together as a unit, an enforcement arm of a multitude of federal agencies in a joint operation. And over the years of working with this specific team, we were able to travel and work from Africa to Europe to South America, and building that persona, it was rooted in truth, understanding the market, understanding marketplace of drugs, on a global sense, not just a small country, on a global sense, whether it's also weapons trafficking, and also understanding the politics in the underworld of how these organizations operate at a managerial level. That was also incredibly helpful. And through my experience of being a DEA agent, whether it's working on the border or in Central America, that helped out greatly.
How do you keep your composure when you know at every moment that if they knew who you were, they would end your life immediately?
That's a great question. And only a friend would ask that question,
right? That's
right.
That's right.
keeping my composure. Acting.
Yeah.
Having the ability to know that I had a good team. And you're not just working. I was the only undercover as the American for the majority of these cases. We worked with host nation counterparts. We had judicial permissions to be present in that country, and I was acting as a global criminal enterprise boss, wow. The number one. So I was surrounded by host nation counterparts acting as my security bodyguards, managerial staff, when we would conduct these operations. So I felt very comfortable, and within comfort lies safety and also be able to provide a proper presence that was needed.
All right, adrenaline, the jazz of it. Do you miss it?
No, I don't. There was a lot of stress. You're not just dealing with targets. You're not dealing with leaders in organizations. You're also dealing with managing the resources and the funding that goes along with it. And from multiple languages to multiple continents, time zones, and having to balance all of that to make sure everybody arrives at dinner at the same time, same place, and not just the targets. I'm talking about host nation counterparts as well as all of the U.S. entities coming in. It brought a lot of adrenaline, if you will, to complete a mission. So,
hey, look, there are scores of people still in prison because of a multitude of investigations you were, central to. You feel good about the fact that they're being punished? Are you concerned that anybody who is serving time is being mistreated or not getting what they deserved?
No, I believe everybody who I was specifically dealing with is getting exactly what they deserve.
Yeah.
These individuals weren't just talking about the sales of drugs. These individuals were involved in trying to change the complete drug market of countries. So we're talking about people who are very powerful in their own right, and not just in their countries. Their actions were affecting the United States.
With no concern about the carnage.
No, none at all. No. None at all. It's about money, and money is power.
Greed, power, desire, pleasure, whatever.
Whatever.
Yeah. Anyway. Hey, look, is this a war worth fighting? Because there are folks out there saying, hey, let's just legalize all this and allow people to make decisions, bad or good, one way or the other. We got about 40 seconds.
I believe so. I dedicated my life to it. I've seen a lot of positive change. I've helped a lot of people. And at the end of the day, as a agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration or any other agency in the federal government, you are charged with duties, and it's your responsibility to follow through on those duties. And you follow what the chain of command requires.
All right. Well, I'm glad you were out there fighting for us. We got another segment to do. So, Red, White, and Bruise, we'll be right back.
I pledge allegiance.
Welcome back to Red, White, and Bruise. I'm Gru with my good friend Christopher Diaz, now retired DEA agent. Hey, look, Chris, I got to tell people how we met.
Let's do it.
Chris has a son on the autistic spectrum. He was involved in a program called PPCD with 6, 7, or 8 other nonverbal kids. 4 or 5 years old, public school program, and all of them were coming home with bruises and injuries. Chris found out and contacted a friend who said, who's the best journalist to deal with special needs issues? We actually met in the Galleria. It was like something out of, a Scorsese movie. And Chris had gone in to the administrators, used his investigative skills, wore a wire, and had gathered evidence of malfeasance and cover-up. And we ended up doing a series of reports that affected change, which is a good segue into this next chapter in your life.
Yes.
You know, we have that bond of being parents to sons with autism. And you are helping the law enforcement community better identify and understand folks on the spectrum. Talk about that.
So, yes, that was a very difficult time in our life. And I remember a good friend, very wise, sage man, said, "Hey, man, all you can do is try to move the needle." That was you, right? And so we tried. We made the best effort we could. And so I've always remembered that saying, just try to move the needle. And so leaving federal law enforcement, I decided, well, what am I going to do? So my wife and I, Claudia, decided to open a company and to work with law enforcement, firefighters, and paramedics. And I have a home. I've been blessed with an opportunity to volunteer and teach at the Harris County Sheriff's Office Academy and also assist them during the critical incident training, which is where that's part of the licensing program for TCOL and Texas Commission on Law Enforcement to keep your license to talk about autism. And I've also found a home in the firefighter community, which has been pretty awesome. They are very proactive, and it gives me an opportunity to talk, share, and not just about autism, it's talk about the caregivers.
Yeah.
And having been a first responder when I joined police work back in 97, I know that you can only do and you can only help the community with the information that you've been trained on. Yeah. And so my goal is to move the needle and to provide law enforcement, fire, and rescue some tools to better interact with our community. We've made some change. We've even had over in Cypress Creek Fire Department, they work with their 911 operators, and they have been able to be proactive after one of my classes in order to help change their 911 system to include some information about autism, which is awesome.
Yeah, like you and I can walk into any group of people and see four or five mannerisms and then look at each other and say, spectrum.
Yep, 100%.
And that's the kind of tool that in a highly charged situation, if a law enforcement officer has, it can de-escalate, it can change the entire scenario.
100%. The last thing I want as a police officer to act on the training that he has and then wind up on some sort of channel or and then hindsight's 2020, and they later find out that that person that they interacted with was on the autism spectrum, and they knew no better. And so my goal is to continue. I do know that officers do get training, but I want to move the needle and provide training about autism, the experience of a family, what they go through, and also how the caregivers might react. I think that's important, the level of stress that caregivers like you and I deal with on a daily basis so that they can even interact a little bit more seamlessly with the public. That's very important, I feel.
Well, and you've worked with thousands of law enforcement officers through your career.
Yes.
None of them want to carry the burden of, oh my gosh, I would not have reacted with that degree of force had I just known what was the case. And the case here is that people on the spectrum act differently, and some of their actions can be perceived as aggression when in fact it's frustration and dealing with a world in which sometimes confounds them.
100%. This year, April 2025, the Health and Human Services came out with statistics. It's 1 in 31 children have an autism prevalence.
Yeah.
1 in 31. That's an amazing statistic if you truly think about it. And I think public servants, I think the whole world needs to know that. This isn't going away. In fact, this is the first time since my son was diagnosed at 2 years and 10 months old,
yeah.
right? He's turning 14 this year. I have been waiting for anybody in any political capacity to move forward and talk about autism. And you know what? And people are talking about it. And I see it, not only is it just on TV, I see it in the community now. And that's amazing.
Yeah, we're I didn't even get to talk about, you know, the four of us, four dads talk every week. Yeah. That's for another time.
Right on.
The pastor, the lawyer, the cop, and the reporter.
Right on.
All right, man, will you come back?
100%,
give me a cheers, my brother.
Cheers.
Okay. Hope you enjoyed our conversation. We'll be back again next week for more Red, White, and Brews. Yeah. Hey, Chris, you're on the one shot.
I'll take it.
I'm on the two shot. welcome to Red, White, and Brews Overtime, I'm going to call it.
Right on.
Hey, buddy, I didn't, you know, really ask you about your view of what's going right in our country and what needs some work.
Okay. You
know, I know that you are conservative. I think I like to think of it as pragmatic on steroids. So, you know, what do you see going right in the country? We've had a major pushback against, let's say, for lack of a better term, wokeness. Is that a good thing?
That's a great question. I believe that we need to deal with the reality of what's actually occurring. And I'm not one, if someone came up to me and was asking me to call them a specific term, or I want people to feel comfortable. So I wouldn't mind doing it, but I do not believe in compelled speech.
Right.
as far as what's going right in the world, I do believe we are a nation of laws, and I'm a rule follower. I enforce rules for 30 years. Rules are important. Fundamentals, right? I drive the speed limit. I don't go into HOV unless I have the high occupancy vehicle. My wife and I, we make our son raise his hands in the back seat when we drive by any constable.
You wear your seatbelt.
I wear my seatbelt. 100%. So I believe in that. I believe that those who are following the rules, for example, if you want to talk about immigration, like there's a whole massive push. Homeland Security is at the top of the list, and they're driving the immigration. and those are rules. What I think people don't miss is the fact that there are so many people that are following the rules of immigration, that are in line, that are paying the money. And should it be that expensive? Who am I to say? But they're following that.
Michelle.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, her father, Tony, who is a Vietnam combat vet.
Right on.
He was a green card holder. He wasn't a citizen.
Okay, really?
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Hardcore. United States Marine. Look, he stood in line with his mother, alternating with his brother. The oldest would stay home with the kids, or Tony would stay home with the kids, their six siblings, while they stood in line at the American consulate in Monterrey.
Oh.
They did it the right way. Eventually, the whole family came to the United States and joined their father. They were not sympathetic to the millions of folks who came over here and did not stand in line.
Right. I saw that. I worked in Monterey temporarily on a TDY, temporary duty station. I've seen that line. I worked in Guatemala at the embassy. I was assigned there. I saw that line every day.
We both have Laredo in our past. You know, I graduated from high school, have family there, and we found out this week that undocumented entries into the United States are at their lowest level since the 1970s. And more than 2 million people have self-deported.
Now, it's amazing when you put...
you say, this is the law, and we're going to enforce it. Now, there's, you know, for every action, there's a opposite reaction.
Okay.
Folks are concerned that we have not allowed enough folks for our economy to properly function, to remain. Do we need to just go back to square one and say, hey, we're welcoming immigrants. We just need to have them come in the right way. And Congress needs to craft that way, whether it's a work program, whether it's a come here as a resident alien and work towards citizenship if you want. I mean, we got to do something.
You know, in my old community, I would say, hey, I'm a knuckle dragger, yeah. Right? I'm a Neanderthal. Yeah. But what I can say is I've seen people who are following the rules and they end up languishing in a system, and it takes years in order to follow through. So there are good people that are following the rules that want to be able to contribute to the society. I think there needs to be work put in order to facilitate that. More immigration judges, more prosecutors, more individuals in order for people to go through the system and follow the rules. You know, yep. Nobody wants to be in line and pay an exorbitant amount of money and wait a decade and have someone cut the line.
Hey, look, during much of your career, heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine were the primary and most dangerous chemicals, drugs coming to the United States with a huge market and appetite. But fentanyl came, and fentanyl put 100,000 Americans in the ground a year. Did that change the whole conversation, the whole force of government? I mean, it was almost as if that was, what does that make? 500 9/11s?
Yeah. I mean,
that's the same casualty number.
Yeah, it is unbelievable devastation that fentanyl has caused.
Yeah,
fentanyl, for example, just to put it, you know, if you had a penny in your pocket, Greg, and you pulled out that penny, it's 2 milligrams, right? That's if you took grains of salt, and you covered the head of President Lincoln on the penny. That is a potential lethal dose of fentanyl. And what I do know, it changed the drug marketplace. It dropped the price. It entered into our community, and it was so, for lack of a better word, invasive, that the traditional drugs, heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, specifically, let's talk about cocaine, it reduced the need or the marketplace where a price, say back in 2019, a price a kilogram of cocaine, which for Americans is 2.2 pounds, it dropped it from $25,000 to $30,000 a kilo. It dropped it down to, I've seen it drop all the way down to about $12,500. Why? Nobody's buying it.
Yeah.
Production countries continue to produce, and then it becomes stockpile, and then organizations, cartels need to offload it, so they reduce the price. It brought it down so much because the want and need was for fentanyl. It's unbelievable. It changed the drug landscape.
Wow. Wow. What do you say to those, and we talked a little bit about this in our first half hour, but to those who say, look, let's go flat out libertarian. It's your choice. And I even made this argument once with the homeless. I said, like, look, we're going to have two groups here. Hmm. We have one group or one area where you get all of the treatment, all of the support, all of the training, all of the shelter that you need to get clean and sober and back into society. Or we have this other area where you have all the grain alcohol and fentanyl your heart desires. You make the choice. And that seemed kind of harsh at the time. But if we want to go that route, we are gifted with choice with birth.
Right.
And people make choices.
Yeah. I personally see a lot of death in that.
Yeah.
I really do. And what's the value of a human life?
Right.
But I'm a rule follower.
Yeah.
And our nation is governed by rules, and I'm a rule follower. I believe in following those rules and going complete libertarian, and I just don't want to see other people. I don't want to see people die.
All right, let's change the direction of this conversation to uplift.
Let's do it.
Hey, man, you're a young man. You're in good shape. You have a great looking wife who also is a tremendously talented artist.
Yes, she is. Oh my God.
And so, you got a lot of living ahead of you.
Mm-hmm.
Thoughts about what you want to do and what the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years look like?
Well, and you know this very quite intimately, that you and I will be working until our last breath.
That's right. There's retirement.
There's no retirement. I'm just transitioning. Well, let me change that. I am leaving. I left government service to start something else. And my goal is to move the needle of autism. My goal is to help people, because that's the way I fill my battery, I learned. And to help people. I'm helping people who want to get into law enforcement. I kid around with Claudia and I tell her, I said, hey, there's some big shoes to fill. So I need to get replacements. So I like helping people to get in law enforcement. And lastly, maybe some entertainment. There's possibly some entertainment things on the future.
Okay.
And I'm currently dabbling with executive concierge for those who want to travel and safety and travel internationally and just take the more the mindset that I would have traveling internationally and help others feel comfortable traveling internationally. Because the one thing that people need to understand is the minute you leave the United States, nobody cares that you're a U.S. citizen.
Right.
And that also, there's no cavalry on the ridgeline coming to help you.
No UEs coming.
No, none. So you need to be as prepared as possible because you're the one helping yourself.
All right, brother. Well, it's been a great conversation.
Yeah, right on. I am honored and privileged to be here. Thank you very much.
All right. Hey. Red, White, and Brews Overtime. We could keep going on. We may keep going on, but we're not taking
it. Let's do it.
See you next time. I pledge allegiance.